Good evening, everyone. Hi. My name's Helen Davis, and I'm the curator for learning at Arnolfini. Welcome to the second in our UE Art in the City talks with artist Tom Dale this evening. Tom has recently been commissioned by Bristol City Council and Arnolfini to develop a public art commission for Ashley Down Primary School, which I think he's going to talk a little bit about later on in his presentation. So I'd like to welcome you to the curiously inviting world of Tom Dale.
I don't know about inviting. On an existential and a practical level, I'm not exactly sure why I'm here. Like a true pro, I'm going to get to know you as a crowd and just ask, are there many people here who consider themselves students of art? And if you could give me a little royal wave just to gauge who I'm speaking to. Good evening, Sith. Thank you for joining me. And then are there artists, art professionals, and those involved in machinations of the art world here as well? You could give a little royal wave. Hello. Thank you for joining me. And members of the clergy. You could give me a royal wave. Okay, good. Right, now I've worked out who I'm talking to, I can then give you the deal. Here's the deal. I'm here on your time. You've very kindly invited me here, and you've even turned up as well, so we're kind of halfway there. If you have any questions, feel free to ask throughout. I have no flow. I'm making this up as I go along. So if you require further details, shout out, raise your hand. Please refrain from rotten vegetables. For the students among us, I figured I should just give you a quick run through from just after I left Sheffield in 97, I think it was, in order to just try and sort of identify how these certain themes emerge in my work. And strangely enough, I'm here in a way to talk about the sculptures, but they're probably just as affected by the films that I make. So the old way I used to describe the work, I'd say, okay, the films are poetic, and the objects are kind of absurd and ridiculous. So this is a kind of early example of absurd and ridiculous. And these were two little toy carts, kind of carts you would have for putting your toys in if you were maybe three or four. And they have fountains in them. There's usually a pair, and they're plugged to the wall. And there's something completely abject about them. And I suppose the reason I'm mentioning this piece is because it did a thing that I didn't anticipate, and that the object itself is completed, if you like, by the sound. So I think, you know, when you're working on, when one has ideas, we think, okay, you know, I form the idea, it's ready to go, bosh, make it, done. But I think you have to sort of always leave yourself open to the chance side of things. You have to leave yourself open to the way that maybe the reality of the objects that you construct in some way change it completely, and that maybe you're not 100% in control. So the thing that really made this piece was the water trickling away, and I didn't really think about the water. I was just like, yeah, there's no fountains in it. It's just I was thinking that the way that they were tethered up would be kind of, you know, powerful. They're connected to the power. And that maybe the fountains, these kind of utopian things, were kind of lost. You know, they would never be in the middle of a kind of grand housing scheme or something like that. But actually, it was a sound. So I'm going to show you quickly two examples of films, and then I'm going to talk about how the films then influence the objects. So this first film is one of the first films I made, and it was in 1999. And this is in the Zachęta Gallery in Warsaw. So Warsaw. I lived in Warsaw in Poland for nearly 3 years, and for two of those years I had a very peculiar residency there, which is a bit like a sort of scene out of Kafka, where I turned up and I called them up and said, hi, I need to start my residency. And the lady just said, she didn't even say hello, she just said, I can't find you anywhere to live, you know that, don't you? I said, well, could we possibly meet anyway? Oh yeah, come in, have a cup of tea. So it was a very strange thing, and they gave me lots of time, lots of space to get on with things, and just enough money to kind of get by on. And one of the things I did then there was to kind of ask myself, well, okay, if I was going to make a film, what kind of film would I make? And in this case, it's simply that the curtain's blowing in the wind. So I'll just show you quick. And there's going to be a test as well, by the way. So, the test goes like this. That was one film. In a way, it's a little question to myself. How can I use, or how can I make a moving image in some way resists, or is moving image but doesn't exist in the same, or use the same language as what at the time was predominantly the language of TV. Okay, TV is fast edits, it's information, but also it's particularly, you know, it's about holding your attention. Regardless of actual content, it's about movement. Of the eye. You know, if you ever watch fashion TV, you know, they don't hold the shot for anything more than like maybe six frames even. So this was completely about making a moving image that in a way resists other images within what we are used to as the flow of moving images. So in a way, it's still an object. In my sculptor's mind, with its chisel, mallet, bosh, done. Curtains. So we can say, okay, a little bit worried here, Tom. We're not going to have another 55 minutes, are we? Really slow, poetic, how should we say, vacuums. Don't worry. Now, I'm going to show you a film that is the complete opposite of this film, but I think that they're tactically, in what I want the viewer to experience or encounter, it's still the same thing, although formally completely different. You may not agree. which one do you think was longer, the curtains or the Olympics? Who said that? A voice in the crowd. Ah, no, you don't get your prize. Yeah, the Olympics is just a little bit longer, but they're pretty similar in length, really. So why do I think that they're similar but different? The whole point with the curtains, in a way, was a kind of a film that draws out the kind of space, in the sense that calm group here, I was surprised to find the general reaction was to stand there and want to know what was just beyond the curtains, just beyond that space, and in a way that it kind of has an arresting kind of effect, whereas the Olympics, I think the first thing is that it's made up of the opening and closing ceremonies from the last 25 years of ceremonies. So you have bits in there from Atlanta, Sydney, LA, wherever. But the whole thing is that it doesn't really make sense, that it's all like kind of overload. And the general reaction is kind of like, whoa, what's this? You know, so in a way, the kind of effect of that film is to make you kind of push it back, whereas the curtains kind of draws something out, opens up, maybe creates a kind of space. This one makes you kind of create a space, but in a different way. It's like, get out of my face. Why is there people in red lycra rollerblading with their heads on fire? You know, it doesn't make sense in that same way. There's a particularly good moment, if good is the right word. The top right image there, which is the coming of Dreamtime, which they enacted in Sydney. They didn't have enough indigenous people, so they recruited from the local acting school. So there was this curious moment where white people were blacked up and then whited up again with ashes on them, and because I've obviously watched the footage quite a lot, you see them in amongst the Aborigines, you see them kind of giving it the what's my motivation here. So there's this very odd discrepancy that within the details of something like that, which is a great spectacle, we find kind of ruptures, if you like, that give us clues to sort of maybe the complexities behind this kind of event. So I'm very interested in that. But for me, how I work, this was made in 2006, 2007, and the curtain film was made earlier, 7 years earlier. It's funny that you still come back to these themes, but maybe use different tools or approaches. And I think it's this sense of maybe trying to apply what you believe or systems being applied that also keep coming back as well. This is another piece that was made at the same time as the curtains, and it's simply a ficus plant, which is the plants that you often find in offices, insurance companies, all the kind of places you want to go and relax. And what I've done is I've cut all of the leaves into squares. So this very strange obsessive performance where I think in my brain that I can rationalize nature. Instead of making these squares, this silly odd shape, let's make them square so they kind of fit together. And again, a kind of thing happens that I didn't anticipate, which was I thought, maybe the plant's going to live a few days, whatever. It doesn't. The plant just slowly drops the squares and then, you know, reestablishes its normal form. So it's very strange that there's this intense act at the beginning of me sitting there for 3 hours, you know, trying to contain this thing, and then there's this second performance, this quiet sort of throwing off of my skewed logic. So in a way, this obsession also plays a part in here, in a sense of trying to sort of pin something down. Now, where the film of the Olympics was about a kind of excess, about a kind of too much information, I feel that this piece is still about that as well. Well, again, connections might seem tenuous, you know, but this is this was actually inspired by a McDonald's milkshake. So the story kind of goes like this: is that I was reading an article and it says McDonald's milkshakes are not really made of milk; they're mostly like potato starch. And I was just thinking, what? You know, not allowed to swear, are you, in Bristol? WTF? Why are they using potato starch when you can just use milk. Surely we have milk mountains and cows and stuff like that. So it's this weird thing about actually using almost too much thinking or applying too much complexity to something. I was thinking, well, what does that do? So then at the same time, in a parallel brain, orbiting in the same skull, I was asking myself this question, like, the classic sculptor's conundrum is, how do you improve on the sphere? You know, if you were like a sculptor for Leonardo or whoever else, your challenge would be to then carve a sphere out of stone, and yet there you were a master sculptor. So how could I improve on that? And my solution to that was to put a wheel on it. So now it doesn't roll, but it can't balance on the wheel either, so it's an object somewhere trapped between. And I like this idea that this is like comes from too much kind of a kind of surplus of sophistication, if you like. But because of that, you then have this thing that doesn't settle either. So after I finished, I did my MA in 2005-2007 at Goldsmiths. Having been living abroad in Poland and Italy for a while, I finally resolved that, you know, that maybe it would be a good idea to do an MA. I think one of the things an MA does for you is it gives you a kind of roots in a city, but it also gives you a kind of peer group. You know, you find yourself surrounded by people who've maybe had similar kind of experiences to you and are working through similar kind of problems and asking similar kind of questions. And maybe you don't get that if you're kind of working a 9-to-5 job or whatever else you're doing. So Goldsmiths was kind of useful in that way for me for that. Coming out the other side of it, I started to think about how could I make objects, or how could I encounter or deal with ideas that were sort of inverted commas with a big P, political, without it being didactic or instructive. And I began to think about sort of tactics around that. And I think I got a bit of a problem even with my own sort of glossary of terms, because sometimes I propose works to myself as questions or as challenges. I don't like the idea of this being a challenge. It sounds a bit sort of macho, a bit sort of like, I challenge you to use a sphere. I challenge you to use a cowboy. It's a bit ham-fisted, but let's just say it gets it done. So this piece is a broadcast monitor. So TV units, they will use these Sony PVM monitors. And there was this moment when 2006-2007, George Bush said something like, why are we going into Iraq? He said, that man tried to kill my father. So it was like a kind of cowboy rhetoric. And I came across this peculiar fact about how if you added up all the cowboy films that were ever made, it would come to a longer time period than the actual period of the Wild West. So the fiction is now exceeding the fact. And I was just thinking, well, you know, that is, you know, that kind of like riding into town and sorting things out is the idea of democracy that generally is kind of perpetuated. And again, there was several other questions orbiting in my multiple orbiting brain. And the other one was, like, you know, how can I bring film and objects together? And this was my way of doing it. So what I've done is I've taken a still from one of the spaghetti westerns. It's a scene where Clint Eastwood and Lee Van Cleef are looking at each other through telescopes and trying to work out how to bring justice to this town. Or in Lee Van Cleef's case, he's kind of trying to just own the town. And the town marshals, who are kind of corrupt, are walking down the street. So I take this frame and I make a DVD out of it, and I played it through the monitor for 2 years. So what you're seeing in there is a screen burn of that single frame, that fixed idea of justice, democracy, things being done, burned into the monitor. So the power cable's there. It no longer functions as a moving image, a distributor for moving images, but it's kind of locked in that, almost like a kind of clot in a way. So this was a beginning of like a questioning that I have for myself of like, how can I use what I would call loaded images or loaded objects, things that have an immediate or an apparent reading, how can I appropriate them and then take that reading apart so that there's an initial recognition that then kind of like falls flat. How can I kind of kick the supports out? I think this is another example as well of making a piece that you didn't intend to make, or you end up finding yourself making a piece that you didn't know you were making. So this is from the MA show at Goldsmiths, and I shot a drum kit. Again, it was about this thing of using too much force, where the ball with wheel is about almost like too much sophistication. This is like too much force. And the intention was to have these kind of primeval shadows on the wall. But really, what happened was, as I was documenting the processes, I realized that the filming of it was itself kind of more interesting. So I'm just going to show you the resulting film. So, how did you feel about the drum kit at the beginning and by the end? Was there any variation in your feelings towards it? I mean, I think the way that it's set up and edited is obviously to make it kind of fun, and then that slapstick and that enjoyment to kind of break down, and by the end for it to become kind of brutal. And again, it was this thing about excessive force. You know, at the time when I made that in 2007, there was a lot of imagery on the news about, you know, kind of going in, bombing the hell out of something, and then getting out. You know, so not that that's necessary for your reading now, but in a way, it's my way at that time of kind of dealing with those kind of issues without having that kind of finger wagging in there. There was a curious process as well, because the thunder that you hear is thunder that happened there when we were shooting it out in Middlesex. And the farmer who'd agreed to let us shoot it on his land, a friend was renting a studio there. And he said, "Oh, yeah, I'll shoot anything, me. Yeah, I'll shoot that. Yeah, drum kit, yeah." Then he said, "Is it dangerous? Like the drum kit might attack him in some way." But what happened was that we were there for 3 days, and kind of at the time I rented a car, and I kept going back, and every time we set it up, it started raining. And if we hadn't had to leave it till that last moment on the final day, and for that thunder to happen, I don't think the work would have been completed in the same way. I think there's a shift in scale that happens with the thunder. So it goes from being a subject and object relationship of like just pure aggression to then being set into the context of maybe natural violence or conflict in some way. So I think Werner Herzog has this great line when he talks about a grizzly man. I don't know if you've seen the film with the bear and this nice man that ended up being a bear snack. And he says, Werner Herzog says, nature for him isn't aggressive. It's just ambivalent. In effect, that, you know, if you're in the way, it crunches you. You know, if it can, it will grow things there. So it's even less kind of emotive than like nature hates you. It just doesn't care. And I think there's something about that in the way that the drums get shot and the way that, you know, little toms get picked off, that kind of thing. Okay, so I talked about challenges before. And this is the beginning of, I think, a kind of challenge to myself to work in a different way. I think up to that point, I'd always worked on very singular pieces. So like, take a drum kit, shoot it. Take a ball, stick a wheel on it. You know, get a plant, cut some leaves square. And I had this moment walking up Streatham High Road, and I don't think many people have these moments walking up Streatham High Road. And I saw advertised in the Oxfam window shop, autobiography of Evel Knievel. I thought, oh, bloody hell, I remember him. When I was a kid, you know, little models jumping around. I went in and bought the autobiography, and sort of a lot of ideas kind of fell into place. As I was reading it, you know, I kind of found out more about him. And the challenge to myself was like, can I make a body of work around a central theme? Because I'd never worked that way. And I began to sort of buy up pieces about him on the internet. So this is an article from, I think, 62 or something. And he's a, you know, before he became a stuntman jumping on motorbikes, he was always trying to sort of make a name for himself. So he took these antlers and he hitchhiked to Washington to protest against the culling of moose in his state, because he wanted to sort of be a guide and kind of shoot them. And the more you find out about this guy who's supposedly kind of hero in white leathers doing these great leaps on behalf of people, the more you find that he's this kind of, how should I say, primal being. So the main pieces that come out of this are the distorted stunt ramps, the images that you've seen advertised in this talk. And these were first built at Centre for Contemporary Art in Warsaw. And this is out on the front sculpture space. And there was a very nice moment the night before they were due to open, and the director came rushing out and he said, "These are really big." I said, "Yes, they're 6 metres, some of these." He said, "Oh, when I saw the model, I thought they were just going to be like this big on plinths." So it was like Spinal Tap. You know, when the Stonehenge comes down, it's too... And he said, "Oh, I need to think about whether this show is going to open." I was like, "Okay, yeah, whatever." So the show opened, and Spinal Tap moved on. But I think what is interesting about these works is that they also open up another question as well, in that when you're standing in front of them, well, in fact, they open up two problems in a way, is I'm showing you these images of them here, but it's quite hard to kind of translate into, like, when you stand below them, like, say, here. And it's quite hard to kind of translate that through images, that there is a visceral, kind of physical reaction about them. And that's what I wanted the works to do. I wanted to make it problematic that you're dealing with ideas, but the first response is a physical one. Because obviously, you know, we can talk about conceptual art, we can talk about putting white squares on walls, or maybe like bending a chair leg and putting another foot in a cup of water and talking about these gestures or whatever. But when there's a physical, visceral response, then you have to deal with that first. And that has to be kind of taken apart. I'm very interested in how that works now. The second thing that it kind of problematizes is this kind of notion, almost like of the virtual. So when you look at those ramps, you stand off and you look off into the distance. And A, your eyes have been carried there kind of formally. But B, there's the stars and the stripes, and there's a kind of patriotic, there's a nationalistic, there's a political overtone. And quite literally, there's a leap of beliefs. So Knievel was his stunt manager. He said, oh, yeah, I'm going to jump over these buses. I'm doing it for you kids. I'm going to show you how to live your lives in a good way. But there's if you want to believe him in him as a person, you have to make a leap of faith. You have to say, okay, I back this guy. And the same happens with many other kind of people who use these kind of platforms. So again, it's my, maybe you could say a bleak way, but kind of a way of talking about how these platforms or these moments are used to put across a very particular image or a very particular message. So this then formed another question, another challenge. I'll just show you a couple of more images. This is from the Poppy Sabir Gallery, 2011. So I made the pieces first in 2008 in Warsaw, then they came to Plymouth, the art centre there, and then I made them again in 2011. A very strange thing happens when you do things in London, is that people notice them. And if you do things outside, I think you have a bit of a challenge in a way, because of the roots of these distributions, how things are picked up, are maybe kind of more difficult if you're a smaller gallery. The pieces are all named after sites where Evel Knievel used to do his jumps in America. So it is very interesting in the sense that here, this one is called the Pacific Coliseum. The previous one is called the Cow Palace. And these places on the edges of town are where city dwellers could go and get some kind of action, see something raw happen. And the kind of country folks would come in and show the city slickers how it's done. It's a very odd place where these kind of activities are allowed to happen in these liminal spaces. So if you think about Ballard's Crash, people meeting up and having these car crashes, they always happen on the edge of town where these urges are allowed to kind of surface. So again, another challenge, another kind of foot on the amplifier, I challenge you moment. So how can I take something immediately readable, the placards which deal with language, which I've always avoided actually. I kind of almost conscientiously don't use words, or I don't use speaking in the work. How could I then use something that belongs completely to language? Well, my tactic again was to kind of go sideways and use signs. But then as a way of kind of talking about that, different forms of relationship, or different forms of control, different forms of kind of identification. Another piece, again, working with what I would call a loaded object, which is the lectern. So I've been noticing that in a lot of interviews, you always see the lecterns there, whether it's like a corporate announcement or a political one. I think, how can I use that without getting drawn into kind of like rhetoric dialogue? How can I reverse that? So in this case, they have smoke coming back out. So as if all those kind of great promises, all those kind of great visions that were supposedly delivered from this strange object are coming back to haunt the speaker in some way. Again, still on the challenge theme here. This is a piece from 2010, which I was beginning to get a little bit tired about this kind of discussion that objects are kind of props, that they're just there for maybe some other kind of narrative or activity that happens or some kind of performance. For me, I have a kind of theoretical. I simply have a kind of question about that, because if objects are just there to be kind of take part in a performance, what about their actual qualities, like how something is made, where it's come from, what does it actually say? Because I think there's certain objects that exist as kind of, a temporary word I was using is they're kind of enigmatic. In my studio, I have what I call my subconscious shelf. And objects that I find curious or interesting, I put them on the shelf. So when I'm working away, having to write or whatever, I can look up at the subconscious shelf and I can look at these objects and think, what am I going to do with that? So at the moment, on the subconscious shelf is quite a few large pieces of coal. Don't know why, like coal. Could be magic. Maybe there's something magic about coal. Or maybe there's something kind of, maybe there's just something kind of dumb about it. Maybe I can use it to block something in some way, grind the gears. So I was getting a bit cheesed off with this idea of relational aesthetics, that the object is defined only by its relations. And I was thinking, well, how can I produce an object that can't be used? You know, as soon as you, these are all made out of concrete, as soon as you start trying to act something out, you kind of snap under the weight. And what would be the, besides, what would be the narrative? Can I suggest a narrative that then conflicts itself or contradicts itself? So this is my kind of answer to those sort of problems. Now, while I was doing the show in Warsaw in 2008, I went to stay with my in-laws. All in-laws are outlaws. And during the sort of coming down time, I noticed that the housing estate where my in-laws grew up was all the houses were built to the same specification. So it's a Polish housing estate, all built in the mid to late 70s. And during that time, it was under communist building regulations. So if you wanted to build your own house there, you had a garage either to the right or to the left. You had a set of stairs going up to the right or to the left. And you had a flat roof. I started to think, well, Jesus, you know, this is weird. It's all been originally the same layout, and now they're completely different. So I started to kind of go around and photograph all of them. I think 380, roughly, houses in the end. That was my idea of relaxing, having spent a couple of weeks building ramps. And so what you're seeing now, if you look at where the orange part of the house is, that's how all of the houses were built on the estate originally. And if you look, if you ignore the orange part using your inbuilt eye editing facility, and you can see the pitched roof above it and the other house there, that house was originally the same layout as the orange house. So what I did was I went around and I found all of the houses that were still in their original layout, and then I found their kind of twins that had been that same layout but then kind of pimped heavily since the changes that had happened in Poland in the early 90s. So this became a series because I began to think, well, hold on, the way that their culture works now is based on this weird infrastructure, you know, of a kind of communist design, and now they have this burgeoning economy. And for some reason, to me, I was curious about how do those two systems just suddenly fit together. And again, another challenge to myself. I said, I challenge you to use Photoshop. So I challenged myself to use Photoshop in a way that made the collaging of it part of the reading, part of the problem, but also part of the understanding, if you like. So this becomes a series of like 9 houses. So here, again, it becomes more broken down, but it's the same theory. That the two houses are originally the same shape. And in some cases, the way that they're cut together is obvious, in other ways it's not. So here, the windows on the right, they cut across, so it doesn't make sense, but yet on the left it does. So in a way that, say like John Szczesny is very clear about how he makes the cut, it's about the cut, you know? The way his work is read is, you know, in the background is the cut of cinema, a very different kind of collage. And this is this is more about the kind of wipe of image, of digital image. Of digital memory. And I think this is probably the more, absurd one of the images. That's amazing. I like this image, and again, it's almost like there's something I don't quite understand in it, but there's something that kind of keeps sending me a signal. I'm kind of trying to work out what it is. And I think for a while I thought it was about almost like a sort of suffocation. You know, when you look at windows or houses, it's almost like you're looking at somebody who's breathing, a head with eyes. And with this, I've blocked it. So something about this kind of suffocation between these two systems that I've put together. Okay. Another challenge. So this was around 2010. I began to think about how that virtual world that I kind of touched on with the ramps, talk about like virtual ideas or this virtual space beyond objects, how can objects or sculptures begin to deal with that? You know, if we're all spending all our time on the net, chatting on Facebook or whatever, if all of our social spaces kind of become virtualized, does that mean that we don't really need things anymore, that they don't really register in some way? So my challenge you moment was to then make an object that dealt with that space somehow, about, also about maybe identities, you know, like identity, inverted commas, is not something I particularly consciously made in my work. My piece is about identity. And I thought, well, maybe I can approach that very kind of broad term, and how would I deal with it? So this is made up of masks, and they're all looking inwards. So you've got Superman and Dracula and Star Wars and that kind of thing, and they're all looking into an inner space. And inside this inner space is a polished sphere. So when you choose an identity, you look into that space and you see all of these other identities looking back. And there's a very strange moment where you're looking around and all of these faces are empty until you see your own eyes. And it's very odd to see like this quite animal-like thing in this virtual space, because your eyes, you know, they have hair, they have eyelashes coming out, and it's very odd to see, instead of it being just a plain image, it's actually something kind of meaty, like yourself. If I can say that to a room full of people, you're all meaty. So again, you know, like the outside again is interested in this kind of excessive identities, excessive images, and excess of how these things hold together. And this has been a kind of constant theme now, about what is this inner space of objects? How does that occupy? Maybe some of you are aware of this very kind of well-established discourse from the early 70s like Rosalind Krauss, who's talking about images in relationship to sculptures, and their indexical images being almost like the dominant ones. If I say to you Robert Smithson's Spiral Jetty, how many of you have been there? So our experience of it is purely through the image, not through the actual presence or the encounter of it. So now I think this is beginning to be a sort of an insistent theme for me. Like, if we then begin to like speculate what is inside here, maybe this is made out of banana. How does that change my reading of it? What does this speculation do? And how does that, in a way, stop sculptures just being images? Now, with that very worthy statement in mind, with that very refined, honed, academic take on situation of contemporary sculpture, I then came up with this, which is a black leather bouncy castle. How did we get here? In a way, it's again about, I suppose, making things visible that are making the implicit explicit. So this is for a large exhibition I had in Switzerland last year, and it's the largest one to date. And I suddenly had to deal with these very big spaces, but also the chance to work on a scale I'd not worked on before, to try out things that I'd not really, contemplated. The director, Arthur, was very nice. He said, Tommy, you should do something big, yeah. I like this castle. Let's have the castle. And the castle, it was something I kind of come up with, if you can put together things that shouldn't be together, then what happens? You know, this thing is full of hot air, and yet it has such a sort of presence to it. It has these weird S&M overtones, but also it speaks of like inclusive kind of country fate kind of day. Hey, let's all bounce on the castle, we're happy. It's made of leather. That's not quite right. So there's these two conflicting ideas in a way of pleasure as well. You know, there's the pleasure of bouncing on a castle, but then there's a very private pleasure for those who enjoy the world of black leather. I'm on really thin ice here, aren't I? Yeah. If I then begin to like protest and say I've got no interest in that at all, that's going to be the end, isn't it? Yeah. So I'm not going to go there. It was purely about putting two wrong things in a way together to see what happens. And again, within the show, there's another large piece, which is a van which has been in a crash. And again, it's important about how is the inner space of this active. So what was important for me was that the van had been crashed. And the second thing was that there's a kind of euphoricness about it as well. There's a formal similarity between the tinsel of the gold, kind of things you see at a party or a cheesy disco, but then there's that crushedness of the impact as well. So you've probably heard this term of Naomi Klein's about disaster capitalism. This idea that, oh dear, everyone's had their fishing village blown away, but great, just cleared the space to make a lovely hotel. So I was interested about how would I express that without, again, the kind of finger wagging about maybe that the sculpture's quality or its potency in a way is how these things that I put together are unraveled. Things that you assume or you think are apparent then begin to kind of conflict and kind of the gears crunch. So another detail. So this is a detail from a large carpet piece as well, which is a 7 by 5 meter carpet. And seeing as they said, do whatever you want, I thought it'd be quite nice to get an imprint of a missile launcher in the carpet. Because it's this thing about, I suppose, objects that talk about other spaces, virtual. I will ban myself from using the word virtual at the end of the talk. I just have to use it temporarily now. So I don't know if you can see, but there's a central circle and 4 feet around it. And what we did was I managed to find a man who had a missile launcher that was prepared to put it on a carpet for a day or so. And we put it down and it leaves the imprint there. It's quite hard to persuade people with missile launchers to let them put it on carpet. I don't know why. You'd have thought that they'd be, kind of up for stuff. So why was I doing that? Oh, yeah. So there's something about, again, I could have, mocked it up. You can get the PDFs of the layout of a missile launcher off the internet. You could have made the feet and put it on there. But why would I have done that? Because, it's not like some kind of truth to idea thing, but certain things happen when you actually do the real act. So you can't see on this detail here, but the weight pushing down into the carpet made that weight kind of present. Like oil spilled on a little part of the other carpet. And just these little clues there that all built up to this sense of a weight, but also of a weird kind of echo of the impact. Not just in the weight of the missile launcher, but the impact that it would have made if it had hit a building. So when the piece works is that, A, it delineates the space as a sense of this absent big thing, but also its impact further away. So there's these kind of 3 stages of kind of impact that unfold when you see the work. One of my favorite pieces by South American, that's called, and I'm going to get his name wrong, Childo Morales, is called Blind Mirror. I don't know if you've seen this piece. And it's just a white ceramic frame, and inside it is kind of like a black or rubbery clay. And just the idea of having a blind mirror, I just think is kind of brilliant in itself. But I think that these again, like a stages of conception that you have to go through. You have to imagine touching that surface. Then you kind of think about what it is to be blind. And then you imagine if you were blind touching that thing, what would you then be creating? So there's these weird refractions of kind of images happening in that understanding of those pieces. I don't know why I thought I'd throw that one in there, just to let you know I look at other people's work. and the rest of the show was quite simple pieces as well. These are rockets cast in concrete. And the way I think that is completely related to the Olympics piece about this kind of spectacle, about the promise of kind of modernism and concrete, the idea that it could create any forms and they would be there forever, which we kind of know is not to be true. But just simply in the weight of them, the kind of fragility, that those ideals or promises can crumble, Okay, so if you spend time with guys that have got missile launchers, you then find out that they've got the things that go on them as well. So when we were doing that, Ian, who's a very nice man, he said, "Oh, do you want a missile?" I was like, no, mate, I'm all right for missiles. Do you want a missile? I was like, no. And I was like, actually, do I want a missile? Maybe I do. If I did have a missile, that's when the "I challenge you" moment kicked in. I was like, well, if I did have a missile, what would it be? How would I use it? And again, what would the content of it be? If I just use this, again, loaded object, how would it be? How would I direct it? So in the end, what I used was the flags from the print system, CMYK. And this idea that the contents are going to kind of bomb these flags onto a landscape and define them according to colours, but also the colour of print system, the idea of fiction, the idea of representing those landscapes as well, the idea of kind of occupying it, putting an idea upon whatever might be there. So this is coming up to last year now, and this is a piece from Ham House, which is a mansion that was built around the English Civil War, just before. and only survived the Civil War by the, inverted commas, favours of the lady owner and Oliver Cromwell. As creative minds, I'm sure you can work out how that deal finished. Anyway, yeah. They're quite garden-y spaces, really. And they have a very kind of heavy weight to them. I don't know, the first time I went to Venice, I had this kind of almost crushing experience of history. I walked around Venice kind of like, oh, God, everything is so old. And I had a very similar experience when I went to Ham House. I was like, God, more old things. But then, again, you know, the challenge you voice kicks in. Like, how can you then use this in some way? So this is Bacchus, the god of excess and merriment. And my way kind of out, if you like, was to kind of create these concrete lecterns, which initially are identified as being very, same kind of vernacular, if you like, as those sculptures there, but positioned in such a way so that you could stand behind them and give your speech in some way. But they're stacked, that kind of orderly promise of kind of democracy is not quite there anymore. There's something about the mass production as well, so that it's not just about kind of aristocracy, but in a way it's also about kind of production, about the kind of the backers of it, if you like. I mean, a very curious thing happened. I think what is weird is that all of these very rich country houses have now been taken over by the National Trust, because those who had the money before no longer have the money. There's that shift in kind of how everything is distributed, and now the people, if you like, are renovating these places and then walking around saying, oh, isn't that nice? Imagine if you were a lady or a lord living here. It's a very strange reversal that's happened, in the name of heritage. Okay, so I'll just talk about one more piece before I just run you through the ideas I'm working with for Ashley Down. And this is a piece from the Latitude Festival last year. Have you been to the Latitude Festival?
No.
Yes? No? Yeah. I found it to be like a sort of slightly like a concentration camp. There was a man on a tower with a megaphone saying, "Put that fire out!" It's like, it's a festival. There was no sound systems cutting through the fence, bringing beer in. It was like everyone was listening. It was like Radio 4 in a forest. Very peculiar. I mean, so how was I going to deal with this temporary weird architecture, this idea of coming together? And I don't really know what festivals are, to be honest. I've been to a couple. I don't really know what to do when I get there, and what is why? I don't know. Possibly I've said too much on that. But I think the question for me was, what do you take away from it? Do you know what I mean? These cultural coming togethers, how do they orientate us in our own lives? How do we fix up kind of reference points to work through? And I suppose, almost like going back to the pictures of the housing estate, I was making visible the kind of invisible functions. So the lighthouse is invisible, but it's still a point of orientation as well. But maybe that point of orientation is a mirage in some way. Oh no, I'm lying. I'm going to tell you one more piece, because I'm going to Cyprus at the end of the month for a residency at the museum, who bizarrely they have the black leather castle out there, and the kids love it. They're not allowed to go on it, by the way, so that's even more problematic. This is one of the pieces that we're going to do when we're out there, though, which is a colour chart. And the local newspaper will print the colour chart in it, and the challenge to myself was, in a way, how can you talk about things as abstract as the infinite and, in a way, enable someone to feel free to kind of play with it? And the amount of times, I've got quite a few friends who've always said, the job I'd always like, I'd like to make up the names for paint. So this one has... This curious arrangement of paint names. They've got Church Steeple, Lost Lake, African Deity, Calm Crescent, International, Terminal Blue. And I think it's this idea again of like deciding on how would you name the colour of the sky that day? How would you put an image or a term in front of this infinite space? And, you know, it was a kind of tactic, if you like, to make it a very light, a kind of playful thing to do, but still, you know, something that we often have to do, right? How do we term the infinite? How do we find a place for it, if you like? On that light note, I'm going to talk about another artist who I like very much, and really shouldn't be showing you in relationship to working on a sculpture at a school. But I suppose it's this is a piece called Meatball Curtain for Robert Crumb by a Norwegian artist called Øyvind Fahlstrøm. I won't spell it for you. And it's from, I think, 67, possibly. So it's a mobile. But he's culled all of these images from comics. And Fahlstrøm believed that there was a sort of something about that, there's a kind of honesty in the exuberance of comics that he liked. And he put these images together. And I think my first thinking about doing the commission for the school in that voice that I've been using quite frequently was like, how can I present a sculpture that talks about the world beyond the school without kind of dictating the intention of the children from the classrooms? You know, I spent quite a lot of time looking out of windows when I was at school. And I think, well, okay, if I'm going to put a sculpture there, then it's got to be something that kind of offers a kind of clue to other things, a kind of a suggestion, but it doesn't dominate the sort of the skyline, if you like. And as I began to think about these areas around schools, I began to come across quite a lot of interesting crossovers between the beginnings of installation art and land art and the beginnings of actual playgrounds themselves, the idea of being a playground designer. This is a piece from mid-70s. And, you know, for those of you who've seen, like, Robert Smithson's work or Mary Miss or any of the others, you can see that there is these influences directly there between how spaces kind of work. And what it turned out was that after a kind of altercation in New York between a kind of park commissioner, that, all of a sudden there was this chance for people to design playgrounds. So that playgrounds suddenly went from being play, from having objects in them, singular objects, to becoming play zones where one was like, you know, interacting and kind of having thoughts and moving around. And that's how the kids were supposed to sort of engage with these spaces. So for me, there's a lot of interesting crossovers there between, obviously, about how land art or installation or sculpture works. Smithson himself was friends with a lot of the designers who in a way have defined what we come to think of as kind of playground and play area design. So these are just some of the things I'm thinking of. I thought it might be quite nice to have an aeroplane in the school. My man who can get me a rocket, he can also get me an aeroplane. So just this idea of, I suppose, almost in a way as well, thinking about maybe, I suppose, ambition, if you like. At school, the idea that maybe it isn't just what is, your ambitions aren't just limited to maybe doing your work and getting your grades or anything like that. It might be about what you want to do after, what you want to do later, what lies out there. So thinking about that, I've also been kind of looking at skylines and how I might use them. I like the idea of kind of intertwining many different skylines together. So you kind of got a knot, a kind of collapsing of space. Again, almost like the carpet with a missile launcher on it, it's a kind of collapse between different spaces. What happens then? And these are, again, thinking about silhouettes as well. So my problem before about sort of not dominating attention for those who look out the window, maybe the solution is to use silhouettes. And if I can suggest, kind of suggest maybe architecture that in itself is maybe supplemented by objects, kind of play with this assumption that begins to kind of fall down again. So there's the Apache on the right, and on the left is the Cessna. Saw a brilliant advert on a van the other day, and it just said, it was an Indian builder, and it said, "You've tried the cowboys, now try the Indians." There was another one as well, which said, it was a glazer, so it said, every pain a pleasure. So if you've got any better ones, I want to know those by the end. And then now, still feeling a bit magical as well, so there may well be some wands in Ashley Down as well. Kids love magic, don't they? I think teachers like magic even more. Okay, so I think I'm going to stop talking. And thank you. Do you have any questions? Say again.
How do you fund work?
How do I fund my work? the majority is either with galleries or commissions or myself. Nobody's leaving until we get at least 25 questions. Maybe 30.
You seem to you do a lot of, well, basically absurd things, like mashing things together and stuff. Like, where do you draw the line, like, for yourself? Like, is there times when you're like, I can't do that, or, like, that's just too nuts?
He's asking me if there's a no-go zone.
Yeah, pretty much.
If there's something I wouldn't do. Probably not. Now, I think it probably is. I mean, because I think at the end of the day, really boiling it down, these objects are about thinking, about objects that fit into a process of kind of discussion or of reasoning almost. You know, it's the thing I often get is like, oh, you like to have a laugh of your work, don't you? There is that side of it. But I think if you think about humour is quite simply about moving big ideas around on a kind of pivot point. It's a way of turning things on their heels. And I think if there is a funny aspect to it, in a way, that is about kind of taking away a gravity off a bit and allowing people to sort of play with big concepts. So, you know, it might seem absurd at the beginning, but I think then maybe the hope is that there are elements within it that have to be resolved at some point. Obviously, you know, I can't force that on people much. Yeah.
What are in your yes, no, and maybe folders on your desktop?
Well, Skeletor's in the top. He-Man is in yes. Ram is in no. At the moment, what is in them? I'm not going to tell you. Seventeen more questions to go.
So, if there are no more questions, I'd just like to thank Tom very much for coming this evening, and thank you for coming too. Thanks.
space.